Station number 10133.
Mr. Weatherly, reel 2.
Right, to continue where we were. Well, as I was saying, if you knocked over a vehicle and a few individual Germans, you didn't hang around too long. You went down there quickly, got what you could, and got out of it. It wasn't too difficult to do because you always chose that part of the road that was on a corner or a bend, and there was only one decent road going north-south, and it went through some treacherous country with steep slopes either side covered in trees, and you just went 100 yards off the road up amongst the trees and you were lost. So you had no trouble that way, but you didn't hang around on the road because very soon they'd come looking for him. As I say, we did a lot of reconnaissance work, and Jeff wanted to have a go at the Asipos. It was one of the original targets that the initial group had gone in to have a look at with the intention of blowing. Difficult one, very, very difficult. We went over there several times on recce, and in those days we just used to put the radio on the mule, and the radio and batteries on one mule, the charging engine and fuel on another mule, and my bits and pieces on both. I would be responsible for those two, and we'd just nip off to wherever we were going. I had daily skeds with Cairo at different times, which after a short time one memorised. Monday 1:30 a.m, Tuesday 11 p.m. or whatever. And if you needed any extra skeds, then you'd ask Cairo for them, which was dead simple because my future brother-in-law was a shift sergeant, and I invariably worked him direct. Even sent messages to him. Double transposition, which I taught him just before we left. And we would stop an hour before sked time and break out the set. Maybe quick racing charge to give a little bit of a boost to my battery, and then we'd lay up for a day and give them a nice long, slow charge. String out the rubber-covered aerial up into the trees if possible, but I've had it laying on the ground before now, which wasn't the best of signals. I mean, it didn't make it any easier to work Cairo with a damn great mountain in the way and your bit of wire laying on the floor. But we used to stop wherever we could. After a while, Eddie Myers stopped this because it became a little bit dangerous, and wireless sets and operators were a bit thin on the ground. I can give you one instance of this. We were walking down the railway line with a view to putting down fish plates, which were just imitation fish plates made out of plastic and looked as if they were fish plates, and they had a little spring and you just crimped them underneath the railway line, stuck in a pressure switch, and the train going along was it sort of induced its own execution. The weight of the train was sufficient that it would depress the rail a quarter of an inch, and contacts would touch and up would go the train. And in that still, beautiful still air out there, you could hear things for miles. And several occasions we've had to hide up from German foot patrols on the rail. And with that radio, you had a little vibrator pack. Your battery, of course, was straight DC out of the current going into the set, out of the battery, and it went through the vibrator pack, which changed it. And it set off a rather loud hum, which with earphones on, with signals, it cut it out. You just read the incoming Morse. But in the still night air, you had the impression it could be heard in Athens. And it was quite loud. And I remember distinctly on the one occasion that I had to turn the set off, give AS, which was the recognised wait signal, give the AS, turn it off, and an hour or so later go back on the air because the foot patrol had gone past, and with the feeling that that noise could be heard at some considerable distance, we didn't take a chance. And it's not very good for the nerves. We went over there, we had a look at the Asipos Bridge on several occasions, and Jeff reckoned the only way you could do it was the way that they ultimately did it. And
how was that?
I was rather... Well, I wasn't annoyed. It was a wonderful achievement. I'd like to have been part of it. As it was, I was a day's journey away. We formed a base and we moulded all the plastic and this, that and the other and wrapped it up and waterproofed it. And Michael Currie, he was a sergeant. Charlie Much, a New Zealand Lance Corporal, both who at that time were both on our station. Don Stott, Geoffrey Gordon Creed, Scott and Imrie, I think, were the two engineer officers. They actually carried this stuff, manhandled this stuff, down the actual gorge that crept in, started off as a stream and went down waterfalls, and I mean waterfalls because I've had a look at some of them. I mean, on our initial wreckage, we did go down and have a look at some of these. But they actually went down there, and it took them a day and a half of carrying all this stuff to get right the way down there, and they could only do it in the dark. And that meant climbing down and up waterfalls and fording deep sections. And they actually went right the way down and went up the bridge underneath on a convenient ladder left behind by the locals that were working on the bridge. There was scaffolding and everything else standing there, and they went up from underneath. There were Germans around. I mean, Geoffrey Gordon Creed, in actual fact, had to get rid of one and dispose of him. He hit him in the back of the neck with his cosh and knocked him straight over the edge into the gorge. And they did it. They blew it, and it was out of action for a long time. And the Germans themselves were convinced that it couldn't have been done other than with cooperation or collaboration of their own guards, as I told you earlier. And they actually shot their own bridge guard for something that they knew nothing of. And each of the six were decorated for that, and thoroughly deservedly so. Stott was put up for the VC by Eddie Myers. He didn't get it because there were no shots fired. But he got a DSO, Geoffrey Gordon Creed got a DSO, Scott, Imrie, I believe, got MCs, and Michael Currie and Charlie Much got the MM, and deservedly so. But later on, they had animals, which was the idea of lulling the Germans into believing that the second front in the Med was going to come up through Greece, not through Sicily, Italy. And to that end, we went mad at the time of our lives. We were cutting telephone wires and laying down stone. One of our favourite tricks for a while, we had two Lee-Enfield telescopic rifles. And I like shooting. I made international level, represented both Hong Kong and Britain, or the British Army. And we used to go down, put a white brick on the road, zero in on the white brick from up in the hills amongst the pine trees, wait for a truck to come round the corner, straight through the windscreen, wait for the relief or the people that were coming to look for him to came round the corner, had a go at those for a while, and then just turned around and sauntered away up into the hills. We blew railways, and the information we got from Athens was so good. For example, when they were shipping up the British prisoners that had been taken on the islands.
These is the Dodecanese?
The Dodecanese Islands. We knew how many carriages there were. We knew the times that they would arrive at different locations. We knew the length of the carriages, so that we could work out quite easily that the guards van, which carried the Germans, and the train that was pulling the train, or the load, would be 63 yards, or 163 yards, or 168 feet, or whatever it was. And we would actually put down, the fish plate, and instantaneous fuse, to the length of the train, and another load at the other end, so that when the train came along, she had an instant blow, and up would go the train at one end and the Germans at the other. Which didn't mean, of course, that you could then sort of get up and saunter towards the train, because they had a habit of putting three or four or five or six Germans between every other car. And they'd be on the footplates and in those nice balmy evenings. And we did blow a couple of trains, but it wasn't something that was beneficial, in as much that we didn't get any prisoners away en masse. We did get the odd individual, the odd one or two that took a chance and got out. But in the main, the train just stuck there. It was still locked up, and the lads were inside and couldn't get out. And the odd Germans, and they were pretty good. I mean, they were down there and lying flat, and they were sending back as good as they got. And the ELAS wouldn't give much help, no help in this at all. We had help from our own 542 boys, and I believe Eddie did a lot up in the top, up in the northwest part of the country. But ELAS were convinced that we were going to keep a British standing army in the country against the day that the Balkans were clear, and where they didn't want any part of this at all. So they would give no assistance. We raided the airfields, strafed the airfields, because the one at Lamia, the airfield at Lamia, had the main road going right the way through it. And I believe one or two Greeks actually went through there and tried spraying it, but there's no way that we were going to do that. But anything to make the Germans feel that the Balkans were going to be invaded rather than Sicily and then Italy. We had, on occasions, a bit of rough luck. I mean, going from A to B, and you'd suddenly walk around the corner and find that you'd walked into an ambush. I had a personal one.
Can you describe it?
Well, it was just a case of walking in and fighting our way out. And
where was this?
This was in our area. Could you turn that off a minute?
You've mentioned ELAS on several occasions. How soon after you dropped did you actually come into contact with ELAS?
Oh, very soon, because they were very, very annoyed that, whereas they were having a bit of trouble and some of their replenishment drops, some of their supply drops had been cancelled and they weren't getting it, we were getting supplies in each moon period. And they came up and complained about this bitterly, wanting to know why, you know, our people were getting supplied and they weren't. Then, of course, they attacked the 542 on several occasions, and then finally they massacred them. Jeff had gone up to Rumilly, and he was going to meet up with Arthur Edmonds, I believe, and Eddie Myers and others. And on this occasion I was left behind, because Colonel Psaros was there, and Catalis, his political man, and they wanted to send a few signals off to Cairo, so I stayed behind, which was not uncommon. I mean, occasionally I would make journeys on my own, and Jeff would, and it was nothing to be left on your own with the Andates for a week, fortnight, month. And on this occasion, Colonel Psaros came up himself, and he was in quite a lather. And he said, I must get in touch with Cairo. I must get in touch with Cairo. He had information that he was going to be attacked yet again by ELAS. And he had been attacked in my presence. And he had lost men. And they were always, afterwards, ELAS were always, oh, we're very, very sorry, and offering apologies, absolutely transparently false, but niggling away at the ban. And on this occasion, he said they were going to be attacked again. And I had 3 or 4 hours to go before my next sked, and there was no way I could go up ahead of time, because no one at the other end would be listening. I coded a message to the effect that Colonel Psaros, very agitated and firmly believed that he was going to be attacked in the near future, to the extent, indeed, that he had personally visited me. And my little radio set up, and the little... I was living in a Kaliva, made up ourselves of branches and earth and whatnot. We were 400, 500, 600 yards from his camp and his area. I was a little higher up for reception and transmission. I coded this and sent it off, and I gave the AS, which was our weight signal, and I gave them weight 1 hour, and I made it top priority 3D, DDD being top priority. And I went back on the air, and they gave me AS, weight, and I waited there and had to keep switching off, because all the time you're on the air, even only receiving, you're still leaving juice, losing juice, or using it. Eventually they came through with a message, and I remember that. It was stupid, and I felt a right idiot. They sent back and said, please tell Colonel Psaros not to worry, help is coming. Oh, bloody help was coming, and where it was coming from, I do not know to this day. I mean, even if it was Wodehouse or Myers or someone coming down to talk to the local group of Elas under Arras, the butcher, it would have taken him a couple of days to get to us. Help's coming, said Cairo. And then suddenly all hell broke loose down the valley. And it spread everywhere, all over the place. And afterwards, there were just Elas. They'd murdered, absolutely wiped out the bulk of the boys, and those that got away crossed the Gulf of Corinth and joined the security battalions. There was no way they were going to serve with Elas, the communists, the troops. The reason they'd joined Psaros, because they were so anti-communist. That's not quite true. There were a handful, a dozen maybe, that actually joined the Elas, rather than lose their lives, I suppose. But in the main, they were killed, and a few got across the Gulf of Corinth and joined the security bands under Rallis. The Rallis troops were the sort of the security police, the paramilitary police that served with the Germans, and were called Rallis troops after the Prime Minister of that time, Rallis, who was to Greece as Quisling was to Norway. And there we were. I had a radio and no band. No one to work for. And they came down and told me that I would be working for them now. And I said, there's no way that I'll be working for anyone. I've got to wait, results from Cairo. I sent a message to Cairo telling them what had happened. Jeff came back, got back post haste. I suppose he was the help they were sending. And he was appalled. It was vicious. We just lost everybody.
You saw all that fighting, did you?
I was there, yeah. Well, with my camp cook. That was it. I couldn't do anything.
What kind of weapons were being used?
Everybody. I mean, machine guns, Smizers, Breeders.
Mortars?
Whatever they had. Yes, mortars. They crept down and they just butchered them.
Had there ever been any attacks by ECHA on Elas?
No. ECHA's a political, same as the AM was political. The troops in the field were the 542 from our side, and Elas on the others. And we were advised by Cairo eventually to make our way up to Anatoly, and then we were found out, and we worked with Elas, and it was shortly after that. That was mid-April 44. We went out, we went up, we made our way up to Volos, and that was around about the time that Eddie joined me. We'd had one big celebration, because after an attack by the 542 and other boys on Dumnus, which was to Greece what crew is to England, you know, the big yards, Martian yards, where they had a lot of foreign workers. We found ourselves with about 40 or 50 Russians and Poles, and we had a big celebration there. I remember I drank so much ouzo that I was trying to work Cairo, and was certain I had worked Cairo, and I hadn't put the crystal in the set. Anyway, they went off, Went across the country, and we're being taken to southern Italy. And that was the ill-fated Conjugal 2. I don't know whether you've heard of Conjugal.
No.
Conjugal 2. That was the code name that was given. They said we're going across to Italy by Kike, and then they were going to be sent back to their own people. And they were sold out, and the E-boats were waiting for them, blew them out of the water.
Somebody betrayed them?
Don't know who it was, but Eddie knows as much or more about that than as anybody, because Eddie had turned up at that time and we got on like a house on fire.
This is Spidey Lawson?
This is Eddie Lawson, yeah. He was my corporal for a while. I had gone in as a sergeant, and Eddie came up and was my second operator. And then when we moved up, and we were going out, because Eddie hadn't been with us long enough to be stigmated, if you like, with the name of 542 as we had. I mean, as far as the Alaskans was concerned, there was no way that they were really going to trust Jeff and I. I mean, we knew all the local Alaska people around there, and we've been pretty curt with them on occasions, and certainly had denied them what they thought was their right, in as much that we wouldn't lay on planes for them with supplies and things of this nature. And it would have been a bit dicey staying around there. Anyway, they decided we would go out. And we made our way up just north of Volos. Went across by Kike to Izmir. Went down by the Simplon Oriental Express down to Beirut. Through Beirut down to Medinaceli on the border. Then went on the old Palestine-Egypt troop train. And a fortnight after I left, I went back to Nerida and started a new life in Greece with Elas, with Major Ken Ellis.
When was it that you crossed to Turkey, approximately?
Oh, I suppose that would be about June, July of... June, July of 44.
Was there any Eddie's bands in your area?
No, Eddie's bands were Napoleon's Airbus, were up in the northwest, up in the Epirus Mountains. Here, look.
Up in Epirus?
Yeah, way up north.
Did you actually meet Ares?
Oh, yes. Yes, several times.
Under what circumstances?
Well, inasmuch that we were going up to Anatoly, or we were going from A to B or B to C, and we had to go through his area, even on occasions. Remember, of course, that the initial intent was that everyone had a dual job, and Jeff was fine with explosive and this and the other, but he went in as the BLO, the British Liaison Officer for our area, the liaison between the British and the government in exile and the Andartes in the field. And to that end, if Harris was in our area and he wanted to contact a BLO, or we wanted to contact the local boss of the Elas, Harris on several occasions would be in our area and we'd go and see him.
What kind of impression did he make on you as a person?
I didn't like him. I'd heard tales about him, and nothing that I saw or... the impressions that I got was such that he endeared himself to me. There's no way. He was a strong, powerful figure, sort of radiated, emanated a feeling, I mean, of power. And I had heard before I ever met him that he was by trade a butcher, and he was as queer as... And in those days, queer meant queer, not the sort of permissive society of today. And you always saw him with a nice rosy-cheeked young aide-de-camp holding hands. And
was that a Greek habit, or...?
Well, yeah, Greeks do hold hands. It is part of their temperament, I suppose. They all hold hands together, and you find that most of the dances are with men holding hands and hanging something. But, I mean, this went beyond that. He was always holding hands, and he was always a nice, rosy-faced young man, you know, probably as gay as Ares was crooked. The tale went that he was exiled to one of the little islands, one of the penal islands, because he was that way inclined. How true that is, I don't know, but that was a story that was told us even before I went in.
What other stories had you heard about him?
Oh, about how he was a butcher and that he took a sadistic delight in torturing people to gain information from them. I mean, some of the tales you hear about cutting a breast off a woman, I mean, that was one thing I heard. Standing there and three or four of his men putting another fellow's foot into a bucket of boiling water to make him talk. A young laddie of 14, 15 with an old Turkish sword that probably his grandfather had had in the days when the Byzantine Wars were on, you know. Giving him an Italian prisoner and telling him, you know, blood your sword, my son, kill him, cut his head off, and all this sort of thing.
Do you think they're true?
Well, certainly, I've heard tales of how prisoners were taken, and very, very seldom did he sort of allow them to live. Heard stories about how he's had two Italians tied to a tree, chest to chest, and a little bit of wood in between their chins with a Mills grenade on top. And just gone a safe distance, pulled the pin out. And
did you see many German prisoners with the resistance?
Yeah, we took a few, we had one.
Was that ALS or the...
That was a result of a German prisoner. Franz Jungwirth came from Dux, Sudeten, and we went down onto the road one night and we blew the wheel off this van, and he was the passenger in the van. The driver was killed. And
this was on the 6th of February 1944?
It was prior to that. It was probably late 43 that we took him prisoner. But being as he came from the Sudeten and he was a Czech, after a while, he spoke as a smattering of English with a very strong German dialect, intonation, whatever you call it. And he became very, very friendly with Bill the Frenchman, who had deserted the German troops and had come along to our group and was a wonderful man, was Bill. Got on very, very well with Bill the Frenchman. He, of course, had joined the German army because he was anti-communist and opted to serve on the Russian front. Didn't particularly like it after he got wounded and came down and was hospitalised in Greece and then was told he was going back to the Russian front, so he deserted. And he came up. And he got on very, very well with Franz Jungwirth. And it was through his intervention and him talking to Franz Jungwirth over the months that